More than 3 billion people rely on seafood to supply a significant portion of the annual protein in their diets. That number will only rise as the global population grows. At the same time, the United Nations reports that 85% of the world's fisheries are overfished or fully exploited. Researchers are studying the global seafood trade in search of sustainable solutions, and that's a focus of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association in partnership with Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. Joining me, as always, is regular panelist John Baylor, Emeritus Professor of Statistics at Miami University. Our guest today is Jessica Gephardt, an assistant professor in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Science at the University of Washington, where she runs the Seafood Globalization Lab. Her research focuses on the intersection of seafood globalization and environmental change, evaluating how seafood trade drives distant environmental impacts, as well as how environmental shocks disrupt seafood trade. Gephardt served on the scientific leadership team for the Blue Food Assessment, where she co-led the Environment and Justice chapters, and served as a U.S. science envoy for the U.S. Department of State. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's so nice to see you both.
It's truly a treat to see you again, and thanks for taking this time. You know, I have to tell you, I first met the phrase blue food in preparing for this conversation, and noted that you've worked with a group called Blue Food Futures. Can you tell us a little bit about what do you mean by blue food, and then how did you first get interested in this topic?
Yeah, sure. So the term blue food came about a few years ago, really. That's where it started taking hold. And it came as kind of a semi-solution to the fact that there's no exact agreed upon term for fish and other aquatic foods. So fish in and of itself isn't really encompassing all of the foods that we get from the oceans and our lakes and streams. Because of course there are shellfish and all kinds of critters, crustaceans that aren't really what people think of when you say fish. The term seafood, then, in a lot of places, that just means things from marine areas and not from inland areas. And then saying aquatic foods started sounding a little bit technical to some people. So this term blue food came up, but a lot of groups sort of flipped back and forth between aquatic foods and blue foods now. And then I guess, yeah, in terms of how did I get started in this area, I'd say the very first seeds of working on aquatic food systems started when I was studying abroad at the University of Ghana as an undergraduate. I had been studying ecology and decided to take classes in their fisheries program while I was there. But the sort of interesting thing about those classes in fisheries in Ghana is that they were really much more human oriented and more thinking about fish as food. And that's a pretty stark contrast to here in the United States, where a lot of fisheries teaching and management is thought about much more as a natural resource, thinking about sort of it as an economic resource, more akin to sort of forestry than agriculture in many contexts.
So, you know, how important is aquatic food in our diet? You know, I've looked at things that you've put up on your artist site, the ARTIS site, and I've been looking at things like how some of the food that I might get from my local grocery comes from continents away. So I'm thinking, wow, this is really we're seeing this globalization of our supplies. But you know, how much important is that in terms of a dietary source for us?
Yeah, so it varies a lot around the world. At the global level, about 15% of animal source protein comes from aquatic foods. But it isn't really just about the protein. Aquatic foods are a very important source of omega-3 fatty acids, vitamins, minerals, and trace elements. And beyond that, fishing represents a critical source of livelihoods, identity, and culture around the world. This is especially true for island nations and coastal regions. So that was certainly reflective when I would go around markets in Ghana, But since then, I've spent time in other coastal areas. We had a big project in Kiribati where the average per capita fish consumption exceeds 70 kilograms, which is 154 pounds per year per person. Sort of for reference, the average US consumer consumes around 20 pounds per person per year. And so that's about seven times as much seafood as we're consuming here in the US. So it's really just plays this critical role as a food source, especially for many of the vitamins and minerals.
This issue of blue food or seafood, it's interesting at the global level, right? And it makes sense as like something to study globally. But the question with global studies is always, how do you track the impacts at the local level? Like, how can you say, like, you know, this global trade is impacting these people in Ghana in a particular kind of way? So could you talk us through the kind of research you're doing, maybe with your lab or that you've done in the past, where you might be tracing some of these impacts?
Yeah, so it is very difficult to scale down. And in general, trade data is reported at the national level. And so we really just have a picture of what's going on at that national scale. And the approach that I've been taking is trying to tackle the picture of improving our data resolution at that global scale to understand which species are really involved in the trade. And then working with partners in specific locations where we can get some of that more local context of what's happening. So I have partners in Chile, and so they've been working a lot on focusing on illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, especially. And so we pair some of their more local understanding of the fisheries with the trade data to try to understand what is happening to the community, the fishing communities on the ground. So it's really about trying to bridge those scales and triangulate our understanding from that more holistic picture down to that more local context. But there's still so much work to do in that space.
That sounds like it's really hard to measure. That there's lots of, I mean, the trade data is representing some of it, but you said there's other kind of patterns of fishing and patterns of grabbing these food sources. So how do you kind of aggregate all of that information?
Yes, it is very hard to measure, and it's hard to measure on multiple fronts. I think this is something that's been so difficult actually to get people to appreciate. I think most people assume that A, there's just one sort of known trade number, and that number is tracking the things that we might care about, like whether it's farmed or wild and what species it is. And it turns out that's just not true. The trade data in and of itself, what you get at the port level does not add up to what you get in their national statistics databases, which doesn't always reflect what that country reports at the international level, which subsequently doesn't match what their trade partner said. And so there's sort of these unknowns about the data sources all the way down. And then beyond that, many times species that are of high interest locally, or for conservation purposes, like some of the squid and octopus and sharks fall under extremely broad trade codes that don't allow you to really know which species or which fishery they're being sourced from. So there are these many layers of uncertainty, and that's really the big thing that we're sort of chipping away at with the Aquatic Trade and Resource Database, is trying to break down that global trade data, get a better handle on what the range of traded products are, disaggregated as best as we can into species, and actually get it back to the likely country that produced it. But there's absolutely all kinds of uncertainty in it.
So you did mention kind of the difference in consumption patterns, just that, you know, the U.S. having about 1/7 what some countries might have in terms of blue food consumption. I'm curious, what's the largest blue food import into the U.S.?
The largest import into the US at the species level would have to be white leg shrimp, I'm almost certain. I can definitely find out. Our top consumed group is Probably pollock, but that's mostly domestic. White-leg shrimp is about 90% imported. Almost all of that is farmed. And a lot, I think about 40% is from of the overall consumption of shrimp in the US is from India. So very strong trade link there.
As you were talking about sort of the challenges of measuring this, I wonder too, and you spoke to this a little bit, sort of how do you navigate speaking with partners like locally that you may need to, right, who might have different ideas about how to protect fisheries, right? So in the United States, we're thinking of it as a natural resources. Other places, it's going to be thought of as, again, as the food source. Then you've got the issue of you know, the sort of black market part of this, where people are, you know, fishing off license and some making and providing this resource. So how do you, in order to work with these partners to do this research, how do you figure out how to speak to them and work with them? Sort of what have been your successes in that, and maybe what are some challenges that you've had to overcome?
Well, the first thing is that it takes a lot of listening, to understand their perspective, their on the ground experience of what's happening with their fisheries, and listening to a lot of different voices. As part of the US Science Envoy program, I visited Senegal and the Gambia, where we were talking in particular about issues of illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. And concerns around overfishing in the region. These are very sensitive topics. They're also somewhat disputed. There are issues sort of between the two countries of fishers moving across the borders and kind of pointing blame on other countries. There's a lot of discussion of foreign fleets, especially Chinese vessels that are fishing for some of the small pelagic fish, so the kind of sardines and small fish that are really important and affordable sources of nutrition. So they're something that are considered food for the poor in the country. Some of these foreign fleets are fishing them to grind them up into fish meal to feed to aquaculture, so as fish feed. And so that's a very hot button issue, but then also, you know, stereotypes around the people involved, and you know, you get into the political dimensions really fast. So first, the first thing is really understanding the landscape, and then the next is starting to, for me, is to start to poke around in the data and really try to understand what the data is saying. Where are the discrepancies in the data? Maybe their experiences can inform what we see in the data, and then starting to look at where some of the most important levers might be. You know, maybe if it's a case of most of the products going into fish meal, they could consider policies like what they've looked at in Mauritania of limiting exports of fish meal if they're really concerned about these affordable fish for nutrition.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and today we're talking with the University of Washington's Jessica Gephardt about the global blue food system.
The demand for blue food seems like it's increasing, and maybe that's just my own anecdotal experience of it. That I know that the advice about eating more of certain types of fish, like you know the salmons and the other fatty fish foods, are really well recommended now. Has that increase has that translated these recommendations translated into an increase in consumption? And does that in fact translate into kind of more demand and higher risk of blowing up the system, not being sustainable? Are we encouraging more consumption of these aquatic foods to the likely loss of this being even available and sustainable?
So aquatic food consumption is increasing in most places. So we have been able to look at that. But it is not all coming from wild capture fish. And so a lot of people sort of are concerned about overfishing, and with that increased demand, the pressure that it could be placing on our wild fisheries, which is absolutely a concern and consideration, especially for places that don't have strong management in place. But already over half of the seafood consumed globally is farmed. And in the US, most of what we're importing, most of the growth in our imports of aquatic foods are coming from aquaculture. And so I would say it's really about shifting the sustainability concerns in many ways from sort of a heavy emphasis on stock sustainability, which of course is a consideration many places still. But we're starting to increasingly see concerns around sustainability for water use, nutrient pollution, emissions off the ponds, a sort of different suite of sustainability considerations, really.
Yeah, actually, as you were asking, I wondered, like, what is a story about aquaculture that you think we need to be paying more attention to? Because I think, there's been lots of like debates of like whether, farmed fish is as healthy as wild-caught fish. And I think there's all that stuff that's floating, but I'm sure there must be something that you think we should be paying closer attention to.
Yeah, so I think that there are many interesting stories when it comes to aquaculture. I'd say the most sort of front of mind story when it comes right now to the US context is that there's a lot of hesitancy in many communities to produce our own aquaculture. There's opposition to net pens in many places, and what that means is that we increasingly import more and more of our fish, and in some ways that means we're offshoring our environmental impacts. So just because you're not seeing it in your backyard doesn't mean that it's not happening somewhere else. And we don't have a lot of tools right now to monitor and try to put some guardrails on that. Increasingly there is some, of course, in the certification space, but there's a lot of room for improvement there. On the trade front, though, the US has goals around increasing our own production of aquaculture and consumption of our own aquaculture. But that, in many cases, would mean shifting the species that we're consuming or having much higher prices. A lot of what we're importing is pretty cheap fish, and that comes because of both some of the production advantages that these countries have, along with cheap labor. So there are many interesting stories there. I think catfish is probably one of the most interesting. You look surprised.
Yeah. Well, yeah, tell us more.
Well, yeah, so channel catfish has been produced and consumed here in the US as a farm species for a really long time, actually, mostly in the Mississippi Delta. The clay soils are really good for growing channel catfish. And our government, sort of in those early days, were promoting the farming of catfish, and we invested in that space, and we started to have a pretty booming channel catfish industry in through the 1970s, 80s, 90s. But then we started to have a sort of trickle of imports of a Vietnamese catfish called Pangasius from the Mekong Delta. They had a variety of sort of technological breakthroughs that allowed them to start to produce it really efficiently and cheaply and with cheaper labor. And so it started to compete with the channel catfish here on the US market. And why I think it's a really interesting story is that the US actually threw almost every protectionist policy we had in to try to slow the growth of those imports. We put hefty tariffs in place. We put labeling requirements in place. We put extra border checks on the fish at the border. And really, it's certainly not reversed the trend. I mean, it's not to say there's been no slowing, but Pangasius imports have continued to rise and have surpassed consumption of channel catfish here in the US, and channel catfish production has sort of stabilized and slightly declined.
What is the largest blue food export from the U.S.? I mean, what you just described in terms of some of the aquaculture for producing for the country, but also as a potential export.
Yeah, so the US is a huge seafood producer. Alaska is the largest fishery, and Alaska pollock is our big export. out of the US. But we are major producers of other groups of species up in Alaska, but also all over the US. We have crabs and oysters and lobsters that are pretty important from a value standpoint as well.
You know, as you've been involved in this, do you worry about the sustainability of this global trade? I mean, you know, are we heading for a crash? I mean, are there things that we should be doing now to help improve the sustainability of this?
Yeah, that's the big question. You know, there's some reasons to think that trade itself could facilitate more unsustainable production because we're kind of distancing ourselves from what's happening. We can turn a bit of a blind eye. And so we're really trying to understand that, but it gets back to that issue of scale, of really being able to connect the trade to the specific production practices to test those hypotheses. The trade itself, though, I guess I should note, is responsible for only around 10%. So the transport stage is only around responsible for around 10% of emissions, which is the main impact category. So the trade itself isn't sort of so much of a sustainability concern. I think that's what comes front to mind for a lot of people because they think about food miles and such. How food is produced is much more important than where it was produced in general. There are a couple caveats for fisheries though, because some foods are actually flown. So fresh salmon from Chile is flown into the United States, and that almost certainly has much higher transport emissions. There's also some really high value live trade of some niche products that are also flown. And in fact, the trade routes, those flights exist almost entirely to transport that seafood. They have passengers on them as well, but they're only economically viable because of the seafood in their hulls. But yeah, when it comes to trade impacting sort of how foods are produced, it really starts with the management of the fishery itself and ensuring that we have responsible management of our fisheries and aquaculture systems. And that's really irrespective of whether it winds up in international trade or staying domestic. From there are a couple approaches for trying to ensure that the products traded internationally are more sustainable. There are import regulations, like in the United States, we have the Seafood Import Monitoring Program, which is really targeted at reducing illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, as well as fish mislabeling. So it doesn't cover the whole suite of sustainability issues. But we do have other regulations around reducing bycatch, and then there's the whole suite of private labels like the Marine Stewardship Council and the Aquaculture Stewardship Council.
I asked you this in relation to aquaculture, but I wonder as we're wrapping up, what is a story related to the global seafood system that you think we should all be paying much more attention to?
The one that's probably the most interesting and pressing right now is really probably about labor abuses. There's been some really good investigative journalism work right now by many organizations, but a notable one would be the Outlaw Ocean Project, focused on uncovering labor abuses throughout the supply chain. When we think about fisheries, they involve, in many cases, vessels that can be out at sea for many months. And that creates a really vulnerable environment for workers when they are not able to leave those boats. And it creates a situation where you can have really extreme labor abuses. It's not just at sea, though. We see this in seafood processing plants as well, where these pressures to keep prices down and produce cheap fish incentivizes companies without sufficient regulation to use forced labor to keep those prices down. So that's an area where people are looking at expanding the Seafood Import Monitoring Program to cover labor abuses, or at least partner with the Department of Labor to really try to improve labor practices along the supply chain.
So if I want to be a responsible consumer of Blue Food, and I want to not have the fish that's flown first class from other continents, and I don't want to have, kind of where it's been abusive labor, what kind of guidance could you give me in terms of trying to be a consumer that really helps do this in a way that's responsible and sustainable?
Yeah, I sort of would recommend a kind of tiered approach. For many consumers, they have access to grocery stores or local specialty stores where the people running it are going to sort of do that legwork for you. So if you find someone who really cares about responsible sourcing and they're spending a lot of effort thinking about their own supply chains, that is sort of going to be your best bet because you kind of go in and somebody else is doing that work for you. From there are consumer guides like the Seafood Watch program's guide to that has ratings based on where seafood's from and how it was produced to say give a sort of stoplight system of green, yellow, or red, the sort of best choice, good alternative, and avoid. So that's pretty handy for a lot of consumers. A lot of people might find, though, that in fact, there's plenty of seafood where the label does not contain information about the specific species, whether it's farmed or wild, where it's from. And so that can make it pretty challenging for specific cases. Those guides are really helpful, though. From there, though, sort of a good rule of thumb is that most of the US fisheries are pretty well managed. So consuming US seafood is a pretty safe farm. Bivalves do really well. The smaller oily fish also tend to perform pretty well.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stats and Stories is a partnership between the American Statistical Association and Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. You can follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or other places where you find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsstories@amstat.org or check us out at statsandstories.net. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.